It was the first time in centuries when women could move and people could see them move. So, of course, some people said that was obscene excess. Other people said it was freedom. So much depended on your point of view.
Hello, welcome back to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack, and today we're turning our attentions to a very interesting period of history, the French Revolution, but we're going to be looking at it from a new, vital, but quite refreshing perspective. The decade we're concentrating on is 1794 to 1804, which came on the heels of the revolution in 1789 and after the Reign of Terror ended. Anne Igonet is Professor of Art History at Barnard College, Columbia University, and she has ended up teaching a very popular course about clothing. She became captivated by all the unanswered questions surrounding this dramatic period, where styles occurred very rapidly during this revolutionary period. After years of painstaking research, Igonet was able to put together a detailed book about three remarkable women who crossed paths in Paris at this time and who upended women's fashion and behavior. So the three women were Joséphine Bonaparte, future Empress of France, Thérèse Tallien, reputedly the most beautiful woman in France at the time, and Juliette Récamier, who was a muse of the intellectuals. All three of them had undergone dramatic and radical upheavals during the revolution, and the avant-garde styles that they pioneered freed up women physically, socially, and politically. But this progressive movement was very short-lived. It only lasted a decade before it was reversed, and it would be another 200 years before women could dress so freely again. So you said this was the fastest change of clothes in history, this particular period. How much did it impact all the way down? You're saying it went as far as the United States. I think the president's wife at one point ended up wearing something that she'd seen in Paris. I mean, was this because of magazines? I mean, how big was the social media of the time? Or was it word of mouth or visits?
You're absolutely right. There was an 18th century, early 19th century version of Instagram and TikTok, and that was the theater. It was not the actresses on stage who were the most important spectacle. It was the women in the audience. Notably, and we have records of this, Thérèse Tallien and Joséphine Bonaparte, word would spread through the entire theater audience. And then people would write letters, reporters would write letters, long letters back to their magazines. They were essentially style reporting that was epistolary in form, but was for periodicals. And then in 1797, two enterprising young men with very little editorial experience, but imagination, launched a magazine called the Journal des Dames et des Modes, the Journal of Women and Fashion. And they caught the democratic spirit of this style. And from the very first issue, they proclaimed the political and the borderline feminist significance of this style. And they tapped into all of the feelings that had led in concentrated form to the French Revolution that were swirling around Europe, North America, South America. The magazine had subscribers in Constantinople. It had subscribers in Egypt. And so the news spread further and further through the fashion plates. And actually, one of the most fashionable places in the world was Lima, Peru.
Really?
For reasons that have to do with, you know, internal clothing dynamics in the Andean region, Lima was just a hotbed of style. And they picked up on this new look from Paris right away.
So this, as you've just said, was a lot more than a style statement. what these women were doing was revolting against confinement, rigidity of movement and thinking. And for the first time, women could move freely and you could actually see their bodies moving. So it kind of affirmed the female form in public.
It was so shocking to many people and so marvelous for so many women. It was the first time in centuries when women could move and people could see them move. So, of course, some people said that was obscene excess. Other people said it was freedom. So much depended on your point of view. What's very, very telling is that among the intellectuals who began to gravitate around Juliette Récamier and hold her up as a visual symbol of the revolution was the single greatest advocate for women's rights, Germaine de Staël.
Right.
Mary Wollstonecraft in Britain had issued a clarion call to women's rights and had immediately adopted the new Parisian style. But alas, she died in childbirth, giving life to the
Mary
woman
Shelley.
Who was going to become Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein. So it was left to Germaine de Staël to carry the torch. And Germaine de Staël just adored Juliette Récamier and vice versa.
Interesting. So you've talked about other peripheral things that happened with this period in terms of style. So we've got the Kashmiri shawls that Napoleon sends from the Egyptian campaign. You've got Josephine's unusual use of the cameo. She practically, I don't know if she invents the tiara, but she starts wearing tiaras. The cropped hair becomes a big deal. You can now put turbans on it, like from the Caribbean, or you can put a wig on it. And then finally, the handbag happens because you no longer have to have the hidden pocket in the layers of petticoats. So this is dramatic.
Oh, it was the beginning of accessories as we know it in the modern era. The handbag was a necessity because these slim Indian cotton dresses just could not have handled the weight of a pocket sewn into the seams. It just would have, the keys that women carried would have ripped the pockets. And so, and also it, the bulge would have spoiled the columnar line of the clothing. So the handbag was invented. And by the end of 1797, it had been declared the single most important accessory that a woman could own. Okay. And that fell back a bit after this fashion revolution ended. But of course, we're living the continuation of that because the handbag is the most status oriented, the most expensive possible accessory that women covet now. It's actually gotten much more extreme in the last 15 or 20 years. And it was announced way, way, way back when in the 1790s. And one of the reasons why we underestimate that is that for formal portraits, then as now, women would pose in an evening gown. You know, Michelle Obama, when she posed for her official portrait that's now hanging in the National Portrait Gallery, posed in an evening gown. So we just forgot how important accessories were. Actually, you know, around the core of these cotton dresses, it spun a marvelous array of accessories, which the Journal des Dames et des Modes promoted as hard as they could.
So costs. This is a very important thing that you put in the book. It's you explain very well about the exchange rate at the time, what the annual lowly worker would earn. And so at the beginning, Josephine is quite modest with her wardrobe. And because she prefers cotton, at one time, her wardrobe in 1796 is valued at 729 francs. Whereas Marie Antoinette, by contrast, in 1783, pre-revolution, had an annual budget of 120,000 francs. just for her wardrobe.
That's a disparity which we can call revolutionary.
Right. So we won't go just yet to what happens to poor old Josephine after Napoleon goes through his regressive period. But this opens up close to all classes. Suddenly cotton is the avenue for people to look quite nice and well put together because they're not looking that different from the upper echelons of society now.
It was, in the most basic physical way, democratic. The plummeting cost of the most fashionable clothes was partly about how these new dresses required at least 7 times less fabric than pre-revolutionary gowns, but also because the revolution had abolished the medieval guilds, and the construction of these new revolutionary dresses was so simple, it meant that women did not have to go to an official guild master to get a fashionable outfit made. Any woman who knew how to sew, which is basically all women, could make themselves one of these super fashionable dresses. One of my favorite moments in a museum costume collection was when a rack of cheap printed cotton dresses was rolled out. Not very many of those dresses have survived because they got worn a lot. But this rack of dresses did. And it allowed me to imagine a flock of working class girls who had made their own super fashionable dresses and able to put them on with no help whatsoever. One of the class features of pre-revolutionary clothing is that it was so elaborate that an upper class woman had to be pinned into the clothes. There were no, you know, zippers and Velcro the way we imagine now. The gowns were pinned into place with straight pins. So you had to stand very, very still while your maid, who one hoped was skilled, put all the pins in. Whereas I learned from these working class dresses that I saw in the museum that they had drawstrings that opened in the front. And there were 3 or 4 of those drawstrings. So you slipped into the dress, you adjusted the gathers on the 3 or 4 strings, you tied 4 bows, and that was it. And you could do it independently.
So there's the comfort factor, but also the smell factor, because you can actually wash cotton, and these fine silks and all these elegant bows, they relied upon the petticoats being washed, right, underneath.
They relied on washing their underwear. But back to the guild situation, those guild masters had skills and they made really elaborately constructed clothing so that the silks weren't so washable and the fabulously skilled guild construction was not washable either. Whereas these new cotton dresses, it was wash and wear. And the bright prints that Indian dyers knew how to create meant that the bright prints lasted wash after wash after wash, which was an alternative to the labor-intensive embroidery on which patterns had once upon a time depended. And that meant, you're absolutely right, that there was a new kind of physical self-confidence that working class women felt because they knew that they were not only stylish, they knew they didn't smell terrible.
So we've got a question here, Anne. How did Napoleon acquire Kashmiri, it says Afghan area, shawls in Egypt?
Oh, because of military blockades, because of ongoing strife between Britain and France, textile traders who wanted to play it safe would move goods through Egypt. And then they would often repackage them and send them under some more or less pirate smuggling pretext onto a final destination. So there was a huge movement of textiles into France through the port of Marseille, which was the closest major port to Egypt.
You're listening to Cambridge Forum's discussion of liberty, equality, fashion, the women who styled the French Revolution, with its author, Anne Igonet, who is professor of art history at Barnard College, Columbia University, where she teaches a very popular course called Clothing. After years of painstaking research, Igonet was able to put together a detailed book about three remarkable women who crossed paths in Paris at this time and who upended women's fashion and behavior. So things are going along very well. We've got all this action going on. There's this mixing of classes, there's this very avant-garde style, there's freedom. So now, because Thérèse in particular is particularly promiscuous, what does she have? 11 children by seven different men or something like that?
11 children by five fathers.
Five fathers.
It's a lot.
So now we're in this regressive period where Napoleon and Josephine are on the outs, okay? And he's still planning, even though they're on the outs, to have this very lavish ceremony to be crowned Emperor of France, and she's going to be Empress of France. Now, this is when he starts to pull in the reins and controls what she wears for that ceremony. And the train alone was 22 meters of heavy velvet. So heavy, she couldn't actually move. She couldn't pull the train. And giving the ladies in waiting 10,000 francs each for expenses. So now we're back up with the grandiosity, almost of back to the French monarchy again. So now we've gone full circle in an obscene way.
It was a shift in the power dynamic between Josephine and Napoleon. So when they first met, she was the superstar and the incredibly sexy one, and he was just this scrawny, strange provincial officer. Then, of course, he started to become Napoleon. And meanwhile, she was getting older, and she also was getting used to the power and money that Napoleon began to provide for her. And so the dynamic shifted, and he caused her to abandon all her lovers. And on the occasion of their coronation, he announced that all the clothing would be designed by his designer. She would not be able to come up with her own outfit. And as you said, it was a weighty burden that he placed on her. Gorgeous though it was, it was a way of reburdening her
Controlling.
with and controlling her. Also on the occasion of the coronation, he broke up the friendship between her and Theresia. He told Josephine he would not allow her to ever see her again. And it was one of the only demands Napoleon made, which Josephine made even a feeble effort to protest against. But she gave in, and with very great regrets that these two tremendous friends never did see each other again.
He also tried to break up the friendship now with the other, with Juliette and Germaine. And he
Well,
didn't succeed in that one.
he didn't succeed. He underestimated their friendship, and he underestimated their principles. They were members of an opposition that, although militarily powerless, was ideologically still very persuasive. So Napoleon decided that he would defeat each of the members of this circle in a different way. With Juliette Récamier, he bankrupted her husband. With Germaine de Staël, he drove her into exile. And he thought that by crushing each of his opponents, he would sunder them from each other. But the opposite happened. In exile and in very reduced financial circumstances, they became even closer to each other than they had ever been and remained close until they died.
So somehow the dress sense is a metaphor. It represents way more than just personal individual style. It's a threat. And also the sexual freedoms that it enabled also are thrown in his face. He's intimidated by that.
I think you've put it perfectly, that underneath the clothing surface, there was an intimation of a radically different gender role where women just had control over their own sexualities. And the embodiment of that was Teresa Tallien, who couldn't care less whether she was married to the fathers of her children. And then to make people even more annoyed and hate her even more, she turned out to be an extremely good mother. She loved these children. Only 9 of them survived past infancy, but okay, 9 is still a lot. And she taught the children who were of politically opposite fathers to love each other. And this just confounded all the stereotypes of submissive femininity that gender difference rested on. So even though Teresa did not intend to become a political firebrand, she was just really in it for the glamour and for a lot of money. She ended up becoming a powerful, powerful sexual threat. And so Napoleon had to wipe her out too. And what he did successfully was to bankrupt the lover that she was with during the consulate, who was the father of 4 of her children.
But she ends up marrying a prince, right?
Yes, she confounded him yet again. Though he had bankrupted her lover, yet she was asked in marriage by a besotted prince, a genuine prince. And so she ended up becoming a true princess.
You couldn't make it up.
And had more children with the prince. So, one of her children had a father who was a regicide, and then she had other children who were heirs to a princedom.
Wonderful. So just before we go on to the last section about the sustainability question, which of course we can't ignore, all of these different women appear in paintings, and it's quite remarkable. We've got Thérèse posing in the picture that's very well known of her holding the cut-off locks. This is after she's out of prison. She poses for she reenacts the picture. And you've got the wonderful Juliet on the sofa, looking like a goddess, very confident, very sexy on the sofa. You've got Napoleon making Josephine kneel for the coronation. And these paintings are all in the Louvre, right?
Amazingly, the nadir and the zenith of this fashion revolution hang right next to each other in the Louvre. You know, Juliette Récamier at the height of her social power. And then Josephine Bonaparte, regally splendid, but put in her place by Napoleon.
And Thérèse with her shorn off locks. And her
sadly did not pose for portraits that ended up being considered as great. You know, Josephine and Juliet both posed for portraits that, for completely other reasons, are icons in the history of art and do hang in places of honor at the Louvre. You know, whereas Teresa had very glamorous, but not as independently aesthetically marvelous portraits made of her. So she's the one we have to use our imaginations a little bit more to think about. But we have movie stars who seem divinely beautiful to us, like they belong to some kind of other stratosphere. And I think to myself, okay, well, like just imagine that you meet Angelina Jolie or you meet Margot Robbie, and you're just stunned. I mean, we are stunned as we look at them on the screen, and that's how people felt about Teresa.
Well, all I can say is it's a great read, this book. It's a great gift. And I learned a great deal. Also, just you finding the path of research is remarkable. The section about how you actually put this picture together, it was kind of almost a life mission going from place to place, from the Morgan collection to your PhD students finding out certain things and putting the pictures with the text. It's really a treasure trove. So you did some remarkable work.
Well, academics live for archive discoveries. And I've been so lucky. Many wonderful archival finds have come my way, and they inspire me to tell what I hope and believe is their story.
Well, I think it's an untold story about the French Revolution. I think it's very relevant, particularly because it was this brief 10-year period that eclipsed and didn't return for two centuries. That's what I found so remarkable.
Women have had impulses toward freedom since time began. And many of those impulses get lost to the historical record. But I think we need to realize that we are irrepressible in the long run.
That's a great note to end on. Before we go, you do close your book acknowledging that some of our assumptions about style are going to have to be abandoned to save the planet. Of course, the clothing industry is one of the worst offenders, and you yourself are wearing all vintage, recycled garments today.
All vintage, right? Because as I've taught a course on clothing, I've realized that there was a major clothing reset in the French Revolution, and we need one now where we rethink what old means, what new means, what sexy means, what style means, what fashion means. And I look at the young students I teach, and I think, oh, they're going to do it.
They are going to do it. You're listening to Cambridge Forum's discussion of Liberty, Equality, Fashion, The Women Who Styled the French Revolution, with its author, Anne Igonet, who is Professor of Art History at Barnard College, Columbia University, where she teaches a very popular course called Clothing. All right, so Anne, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your zest for the topic.
Thanks so much for chatting with me.
Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, the Lowell Institute, Mass Cultural Council, Cambridge Community Foundation, and of course, all of you. So if you want to donate or sign up to our list, please visit the website, cambridgeforum.org. Thank you all for joining us, and I hope to see you all soon.